This is the Greenian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
From hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Greenian Bunker, my friends, welcome. You've locked into another week of the very best in the weird, the unusual, the unexplained, the high strange. That's right, my friends. I am the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, joined in studio, as always, by co-host and producer Chris Hayes. Matt Oakley taking a leave of absence this week. My friends, nonetheless, it is and will remain the Greenian Report. Glad to be here with you again. Chris, how are you, man? You're doing great. You're looking just fabulous.
No, I am fabulous. I just want you to know, though, Micah, in the time it took for you to introduce me, Nick Redfern has already listened to the show and written his review of it on Intrepid Blog.
Oh, my gosh. We've been having so much fun this week here in the land of the pie, Asheville, North Carolina. And I mean pie because you know what? Pie only works if you let it slick, right? Chris and I were enjoying some coffee and apple pie for a change here before the program this week. Apple pie, just like Mama used to make it. Of course, Mama didn't live in the Moho, and her secret ingredient wasn't that special Moho moss that grows on the cave walls down here. But I digress. Yes, we're working right now on the institution of an all-new meme here at Greenian International Headquarters. You know, some people spend their time doing very important things. You know, they write contracts and things like that. They design architecture. You know, they advance the sciences. Like, boy, you've heard all about the Higgs boson. Okay, the God particle allegedly discovered over there. Yeah, by the fine folks at CERN. No need to dig into the details right now because really, I think you've probably heard about it by now. And last week, prior to our special 4th of July broadcast, this was just, I mean, there were hints coming out about this. And immediately after we left the airwaves, lo and behold, there we were sitting there in the bunker doing our wrap-up after the program, and there was allegedly a video that had been accidentally leaked. Oh, come on. Don't tell me that was an accident. They were so excited about getting this information out. And literally, I was just, my inbox was flooded with emails the next morning. Yes, this is a milestone in our understanding of the standard model of physics. We are now dealing with the apparent presence of a new kind of particle, much heavier than other particulars. The alleged Higgs boson, the alleged God particle itself. But again, the mainstream media, who we trust and love so much, they've already done a fantastic job keeping us up to date on what's been going on with that. No need to get into it here. I thought I'd at least throw it out there just so that you know that I read the news. But despite all this incredible stuff going on, I felt it was far more important this week, thanks to the prompting of our friend Red Pill Junkie, who I'm proud to say is the latest blogger to join the ranks of Intrepid Magazine. If you head over to the Intrepid Mag blog, that's intrepidmag.com/blog. You can see the latest edition by our good friend Red Pill Junkie, who wrote an interesting piece called Redfernigma, the Enigma of Nick Redfern. And right there, front and center at the top of the page, he's got this picture linked of Nick Redfern, and it says, "While you read this, I just finished another book." And I joked, I said, "You know what, RPJ? We need to start a new meme that takes photos of Nick Redfern and asserts the sorts of silly things that the guy..." You know, it's not silly, it's incredible what he does, but let's make a meme that talks about the accomplishments of Nick Redfern, and yes, as most memes do, in a silly way. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with what I'm talking about when I say a meme, think along the lines of, actually, you know, Chris, this is a bit of trivia. If I remember correctly, Richard Dawkins, I think, was the one who coined the term meme. I believe that's actually who coined that term.
Yes, that's correct.
Many moons ago.
Yes.
Well, a meme, okay, that the listeners of this program would be very hip to would be, "I think, therefore, aliens." And you've seen the picture of Giorgio. You know, we should ask him about that this year at Paradigm Symposium. Giorgio, what do you think about "I think, therefore, aliens," right? But you've seen the picture. It's got that great shot of him with the awkward expression on his face sitting there. "I don't know," or "I think, therefore," there are different variations of it. "Therefore, aliens."
You know, I'm just absolutely waiting for the time, you know, after the cocktail hour and after the panel, when you and Scotty and I and are having a chance to hang out with Giorgio.
Just the four of us.
Off the record, just having drinks and be like, so So, Giorgio.
Well, Irene Adler may have to be there with
well,
me.
Well, Irene Adler can be there. The woman.
The woman. The supreme archetype.
But anyway, you
That's
know,
code.
Hanging out with George and... Or Giorgio. Sorry. My bad. Talking to him, he'd be like, hey, so Giorgio, really? And he'll just say, like, I don't believe in any of this. It's just the money. I think they're for money.
And he pulls off the wig.
And he's actually Uncle Jesse.
From
Giorgio Tsoukalos is John Stamos.
Hey. Well, I didn't see that one coming. Well, okay, so, but folks are familiar with the meme, at very least. So... I told Scotty Roberts we should do this, and sure enough, he beat me to the punch and had already designed a meme, and we're going to have a bunch of these. Actually, if you go over to the Intrepid blog and you scroll down the page on that post, we've already linked a couple of those in the comments section, and Nick commented, because Scotty's been linking them to his Facebook as well, and Nick ended up commenting, Nick Redfern, prolific author of all things Fortean, commented, my God, how many of these are there? And there are a lot, and therefore, we thought that... how better to actually do these? I could read them to you, but if Chris would, you know, help me out here and cue some creepy music, I think, there we go. I think that that would make this a lot more fun, okay? This will give you an idea of the kind of memes we're trying to create. As you read this, Nick Redfern is paying an unexpected visit to the Men in Black and then writing 65,000 words about his encounter. Okay, you got it? That sort of thing. Here's a good one. I like this one a lot. As you read this, Nick Redfern has already been to Area 51 and lived to write about it. Now, of course, there are pictures that accompany this. You'd have to go to the blog and check this out. Here's the one that Scotty did that I love. As you read this, Sasquatch is out taking molds of Nick Redfern's footprints just to see whose are really bigger. What about this one? Okay. Hold on. Sometimes you gotta stop the music for a minute. Okay, you ready? Here we go. As you read this, Nick Redfern has already tracked the monster to its lair and written 75,000 more words about it than you did.
I'm just expecting a call any minute from Nick. Hey, guys, put it!
As you read...
I'm not that busy.
As you read this... Oh, he's busy, all right. As you read this... Nick Redfern has already uncovered a new global government conspiracy.
And told Alex Jones about it.
You don't give whiskey to a god!
Can we give whiskey to a Nick Redfern?
Oh, Nick Redfern drinks margaritas, my friend.
Oh, well, that's because he's in Texas. Get him out of his element. We'll get him back on the gin. I know they like gin there.
That's right.
Not in Texas.
That's right.
England.
So what we encourage people to do is go find your favorite photograph of Nick Redfern online and doctor the image, post it up at the Intrepid blog in the comments section. We want more Nick Redfern memes. We want to show that Limey how much we like him. And let me tell you, folks, he's actually a field correspondent for this program. We like him a lot here at the Grayling Report.
You know what? Let's call him. Let's call him, see how he feels about it right now.
You know, if Nick weren't so busy, I actually would call him. I mean, we do try and talk on the phone and catch up pretty frequently. And sometimes at the last minute, we can get him on the program like that. But he really is probably finishing another book today. So
by the time you call him, he's already fashioned a saddle from leather by hand and lassoed a Sasquatch and rode it to Narnia.
Yeah, it's so, like, why are we worrying about capturing Bigfoot? Like, you know, Sasquatch has already been captured and Nick Redfern
already has three of them in his backyard.
Yeah, I mean, he's like written three books about it too. But anyway, Nick's written so many books that it's impossible probably to even find all of them because, you know, they've all been like, I don't know.
Well, do you think he's written more books than Brad Steiger?
That's a close one. That's a really...
Because Steiger comes out with like five books a year.
Steiger is probably one of the only guys who is as prolific as Nick Redfern. Now, I've asked Brad since last year, when can we get you on the program, man? It's been... We had an interview with Brad from years ago that I featured on the show, and he said maybe during our mutual favorite month of the year, October, we can do that. But of course, you know what's going on in October. Paradigm Symposium.
Yeah, October is going to be the busiest month of the year for both me and you.
Yeah, and probably Brad Steiger, too, which makes me wonder, why is Brad Steiger not going to be at Paradigm Symposium?
Because he's writing a book that chronicles all the different types of people who are going to be at Paradigm Symposium.
Yeah, see, it's these kinds of prolific authors. Chris, if you and I could write books as quickly and as prolifically as Brad Steiger and Nick Redfern, well...
I just published a book in the time it took you to say that.
Chris's latest book, How to Finish a Book During One of Micah's Monologues.
It's not that hard.
It's not that hard. They're long enough. I think almost anyone could do it. Oh, you know, I also have to say, though, while folks are over at the Intrepid Mag blog, and if you haven't been to the Intrepid Mag blog and you want to find a quick way to get to this, just go to the Graylian Report. I'm sure the listeners of this program have been to the website, www.graylianreport.com. We've got it linked up over there. There has been a very interesting series of photographs that landed in the lap of Scotty Roberts, of course, the publisher of Intrepid Magazine, and our good friend who is helping me put on Paradigm Symposium. Scotty was sent these photos by one of our readers, Greg Archer. And so I did a blog post for the Intrepid blog about this. And, you know, actually, the ensuing investigation, if we have time before the next edition of Intrepid actually is released, I'd like to try and do an update and a much more thorough piece on this. Because what these lights in this series of photographs by Greg Archer resemble are the famous Phoenix Lights case. I'll go ahead and just kind of frame what we're hearing about here, but again, I encourage you to go over to the Intrepid Mag blog, and that website again, intrepidmag.com/blog. Scroll down the page, you'll see UFOs over Colorado, media ignores stunning photos of lights during the storm. And this article has been pretty popular. I mean, we've been flooded with thousands and thousands and thousands of visitors to the site over the last few days, thanks to, you know, linkage at various places. The Anomalous carried it, Coast to Coast carried the article. A lot of the big sites have been linking to this, and we've had, gosh, I think right now we're looking at, it says 100 comments. I think they've actually probably, since I refreshed the page, been more than 100 comments on this. And unfortunately, most of those comments are people of the skeptical debunker type, which we're going to be touching on a little later in the program today. Look, we consider ourselves skeptics, Chris and I, but we don't go into our skepticism with preconceptions and belief, okay, hoping to prove to our own satisfaction this or that. Okay, we don't go into this hoping to disprove or to prove based on what we believe at the outset. We go in, you know, kind of with a blank slate, and we hope to gather data, okay, data that will help us to determine what we may be dealing with, and then we base our judgments thereafter on the data that is presented, okay, on the facts that we're able to discern from any given set of circumstances. And I see that while there are a lot of folks who, especially in the field of ufology, go into it believing that UFOs are obviously extraterrestrial, or we see people in the field of, you know, parapsychology going into a haunted house with the preconception that ghosts are spirits of the dead, how the hell do we know that? Tell me how we're supposed to know that. Where's the proof that ghosts are spirits of the dead? They appear to be that, but can we prove that scientifically? Some UFO craft appear to be flying down from the heavens, but do we know with certainty that these things are extraterrestrial aircraft from Zeta 2 Reticuli? No, we don't. The skeptic arms himself with facts and not with preconceptions. But it goes both ways. And the skeptic is not one who can go into a circumstance saying, I know already that ghosts and UFOs don't exist, and therefore I'm just going to debunk it no matter what the evidence states. A lot of the people who attach themselves to the culture that they call skepticism do just that. And Scotty Roberts, this past weekend, sat in on a panel discussion where, I'll just put it to you like this, he was essentially ambushed. There are two PhD professors, and then there was Scotty and one of his associates. He was not told it would be a formal debate. Each party would be given 5 minutes to talk and then, you know, rebuttals and all this stuff. And that the PhD professors were going to be PhDs and also self-proclaimed skeptical debunkers who would be quoting passages from things like Scotty's book Rise and Fall of the Nephilim and taking him to task on that. Scotty held his own very well because I think Scotty, again, approaches this all very philosophically. But there is a kind of, you know, cult of belief and personality that both sides, the believers and the skeptics, attach themselves to. Well, here at Graylian International, folks, we plant ourselves smack dab in the middle, and that's what we've done with regard to this apparent case of strange, anomalous illuminations over Colorado. And yes, at least according to the photographer, the media seemed to ignore this story. In fact, the story where it has been linked elsewhere on the web since going live at the Intrepid Mag blog has been reworded and retitled to such things as Fox News intentionally ignores UFOs over Colorado. Well, yes, it was Fox News affiliates in the area that Greg Archer contacted and gave the images to, but then they apparently never went live with these. And there could be a variety of reasons why they didn't, but, you know, at least for the purposes of the conversation, they appeared to ignore it. Whether that was an intentional act of ignorance or if it was, you know, they just didn't get around to it, weren't interested enough in what was being seen. The photos appear to show, in midst of a tremendous lightning storm, a series of lights hovering roughly at the same altitude in a line over the town of Castle Rock, Colorado. It's quite interesting. And Greg Archer, the photographer, had been outside at the time, about 4 or 5 minutes from his home. He lives there in Castle Rock, and he sent these photos along. They were photographed on June 6, 2012, during a tremendous lightning storm. Now, Archer is a professional photographer. He owns a lot of different cameras, and he had been photographing the lightning when these objects appeared. According to personal correspondence I've had with Greg, he had not been able to see the lights at first. He was taking the photographs. They began to show up in the photos that he was taking. Within a few minutes, they became visible to the naked eye and remained as such for about 5 minutes. And then they slowly began to fade, but he continued to take photographs and was able to still perceive through the camera's lens the lights in the distance. So he passed these images along to Intrepid publisher Scotty Roberts, and I linked them there at the Intrepid blog. Now, we don't know what these things are, but again, you can see a number of images there at the site that show these objects, whatever they were. We've got a few thoughts, and when we come back from this break, we're going to get into what the best and the most likely solutions to the problem are. But I'm going to tell you, this is going to spill over into a bit of a debate of our own here this week on the program about the skeptics versus the believers, because this has been more interesting than just a UFO sighting for me and for Scotty Roberts and for Chris Hayes. Yes, for us, it has been, well, a bit of cultural commentary. We'll tell you why when we come back here on the Graylian Report. While they say never judge a book by its cover, most often people do. And having a great-looking cover may be the factor that determines whether your book will be read by a few hundred readers or a few hundred thousand readers. When it comes to finding great art for your self-published work, and at an affordable price, look no further than Green Alien Art. The style, skill, and talent of Rick Green will enhance any print publication or ebook, and something you've spent months or maybe years writing deserves a well-thought-out and professional cover design. Don't let your book be judged by its cover. Let it bring your book to life with Green Alien Art. Online at greenalienart.com.
On the battlefield, there's a saying America's military men and women live by. Never leave a fallen warrior behind, ever. Off the battlefield, Wounded Warrior Project operates with the same goal. Wounded Warrior Project was created to help our men and women returning home with the scars of war, whether those scars are physical or mental. Wounded Warrior Project. We never leave a fallen warrior behind. Ever. Learn more about what we do at woundedwarriorproject.org.
You know, they say when it's storming outside, it's dry indoors. And when the storm of everyday life is raging around the exterior, you can always seek refuge within. Especially here in the bunker, along with the Graylian gang, keeping you company each week. It is the Graylian Report. Glad to be your, well, your ambassadors to the unexplained, as always. You know, we were talking before we went out to the last break about this series of photographs that we featured over at the Intrepid Magazine blog. And I hope that this month in the new edition that we'll be able to get some updates. I've actually got some folks who are far more well-equipped in terms of who they know and their access to flight data and things like that. I've got some folks, in the official areas who've agreed to help me try and dig up some information about this. You know, folks who have, you know, history working in aviation and, you know, people who, have a lot of experience, you know, working with photo analysis and this sort of thing. As opposed to trying to do all that myself, I always like to try and go to people who are a little bit better at it than I am, and people who are a little more in the know and equipped with the right tools for this sort of thing. Because, again, this is a series of photographs that are very interesting to me. And I'll tell you this, the best explanation that we've been given for what we're seeing in the photos taken by Greg Archer on June 6th over Castle Rock, Colorado, the very best explanation that we've been given at present seems to be that that what we are seeing are maybe the landing lights of commercial aircraft coming in for a landing. But we know, and granted, we can't prove that. There have been a lot of theories that have been put forth, one of them being that we're seeing ball lightning. Another theory was what are known as dead pixels on his camera. Greg, however, of course, is pretty well, he's pretty knowledgeable. He's interested in UFOs, but he's pretty knowledgeable about this sort of thing. When he sent the photos to Scotty, he included some commentary. Here's what Greg actually had to say. He said, I thought you and your fans might enjoy a couple of pictures I took of what he referred to, again, as some unidentified lights. They were taken June 6th at 10:54 p.m., and the second photo that he includes is 10:58. There were other photos, he tells us, during what he describes as one of the worst storms to ever hit Colorado. Now, just to give you an idea, we sustained 18K worth of damage. The pictures were picked up by Fox News, who never ran the story. According to NORAD and the Air Force Operations Center, whom Greg contacted himself, all flights, including military, they say, were grounded at the time. There's no mountain there, only hills that reside much lower than the lights in the distance. Greg has also agreed to return to the spot in broad, clear daylight and take similar photographs to help us determine clearly that there are no mountains in the distance. The lights appeared when I wasn't looking and slowly faded away 20 minutes later. So far, a meteorologist that I've shown these images to is dumbfounded, and the Air Force can't or won't explain. I have pictures in raw format with Nikon's tamper-proof seal, something the Nikon D700, which he used, is able to do and helps prove that a picture has not been tampered with. So he claims that utilizing that feature, we can determine that these images have not been edited after the fact, and that what appears in the images was indeed there at the time the photos were taken. He had been taking long exposures so as to capture the lightning of the storm, and that had been his purpose for taking these photos to begin with. And then, of course, these images begin to show these strange lights. Well, of course, we begin to get responses. Our very own Mike Reese was the very first to leave a response in the comments section, which, as I see, we're up to 105 responses now. Mike said it looks almost like these lights could be part of a big craft that might be utilizing some sort of a cloaking technology. Who knows? But there were other more, well, conventional explanations. Maurice commented right afterward and said, nice set of reflective lights. Most professional photographers would know better. Well, this was a continuous assertion that many people who were coming to the website would make. They continued to note that it was pretty clear that these lights were reflecting off of the glass that Greg was photographing these from, because they assumed naturally he had been indoors at the time the photos were taken. So I actually went back in there myself, being the editor, and I amended this with an update. And I state as follows. Since posting the photos featured in this article, we've received a number of questions regarding the circumstances under which the photos were taken. And therefore, some of the most asked questions have been, one, was the photo taken indoors and perhaps through glass that might have reflected the illumination seen in the photo? Well, no, Greg indeed had been outside. He even gave directions, specific directions, on how to get to the site. He says, driving west on Meadows Parkway in Castle Rock, he says, turn left on Low Meadow Drive, continue to the second street on your right, which is called Black Canyon Way. Drive approximately 200 feet past Black Canyon Way and then look to your left. There you will see a field, and that's where he said he'd been standing. I'd asked him the direction, north, south, east, west, which direction he had been facing as well, and I'm waiting to get that information from Greg, in addition to some photos taken during daylight. I've also inquired with regard to what airports are in the area. I know that there are two. I think the Denver International Airport is the largest international airport in the region. There's a smaller airport close by, I think 15 miles to the north of where Greg had been when the photos were being taken. But according to one aviation expert I've spoken to who asked for anonymity, I've been told that it's very unlikely that at that time, late in the evening during a storm, a small airport along those lines would have had that many incoming flights, and that the lights that we are seeing are the landing lights or something, some sort of a light on these aircraft that are lining up and preparing to land. Now, Denver International Airport could be, but what I'm trying to determine, and I need more information right as of right now when we're telling you this, I'd like to know with regard to what direction Greg had been facing at the time that the photographs were taken and on the date and during the storm, would he have been placed between the approaching aircraft and the Denver International Airport? Would they have been at an altitude roughly consistent with where the lights appear in the photographs? And had there been, and can it be confirmed that there were that many commercial aircraft that were preparing to land at that time? You know, these are the kind of questions that we like to ask when we are dealing with unexplainable illuminations. Now, we've gone about this, okay, Scotty and I, working with Greg and trying to get details. We haven't said, I mean, they are UFOs by definition, unidentified. They appear to be aerial illuminations, so they're flying, for lack of a better term. And they are objects of some sort, but we might prefer to use the expression UAP, unidentified aerial phenomenon, rather than unidentified flying objects, because flying usually entails wings and lift. These are aerial illuminations. They are some variety of phenomenon. Frankly, if they are not some sort of conventional phenomena that just due to the circumstances looks very anomalous, I'm pretty excited by the notion that what we could be seeing here is some variety of as yet unexplained natural phenomenon, maybe a very peculiar ball lightning-esque formation. That would be very unusual and interesting to me. And these are the sorts of things. I'm sorry, Chris, were you trying to jump in there a moment ago, by the way?
No, I was going to make a joke.
An inane comment. Well, I'm trying to be serious here. You skeptics!
No, I'm not skeptic. I just wanted to ask where in which area UFO, with wings and lift, or UAPs, where in that little area, where do NFTs fit in?
The non-flashy things?
The non-flashy things, yes.
I think that there would be UAP.
UAP, okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. I just wanted confirmation.
Yeah.
See, not skeptic at all, but still probably... would have lightened the serious mood you're trying to get across.
Well, I appreciate that you did that. That helped, actually. Because, we got anything but lightheartedness from the people commenting on this blog. I love some of these comments. I'm just going to scroll down and look at a few of them. Again, nice set of reflective lights. Most professional photographers would know better. You know, this kind of condescension is just incredible. Greg, of course, responds, "Forgot to mention this picture was not taken with a UV filter or any other filter attached." Oh, I'm sorry, he commented previously. Here's the one. He says, "Your comment's a little abrasive, Maurice, especially for throwing a conclusion out there with no explanation. Fortunate for me, I do know better, and that's why the pictures are up for debate. These manifestations are emitting their own light." Of course, he had been outside at the time, and that these did not appear to be reflections, because what would they have been reflecting off of had he been standing outdoors? We see another comment here from an individual who says, "It's ball lightning, folks. Why is everyone," or he says, "why is everything a UFO these days? Can we, eliminate the term UFO sometime this year and start calling stuff what it really is for a change? UFO doesn't mean aliens 99% of the time. That's the lesson to be learned on the internet." Did we ever, in my post, I titled the actual article here, "UFOs Over Colorado," because they are unidentified flying objects. They are unidentified aerial phenomena. There's something... we're trying to determine what they are, but nobody said spaceships. Nobody said aliens. So again, we have someone with a very abrasive, debunking attitude who is there asserting it's ball lightning, folks, obviously. Now,
well, are they still upset that we've been spamming their subreddit? Because that seems like, a prevailing theme. Like, everyone's just so damn angry. Why would you ever think something's a UFO? It's not an alien. Well, no.
It's a UFO.
It's not an alien. It's
did we say spaceship from outer space? Did we say spaceship from
just because I call you a hero doesn't mean I'm going to eat you like a sandwich. It's a UFO, an unidentified flying object. And a UFO could be a Frisbee. Until you realize it's a Frisbee, and then it's not a UFO. But before you realized it was a Frisbee, guess what? It was a UFO!
It was a UFO! I think, therefore, UFO. But, the thing is I love how someone clearly has the answer here. It's ball lightning, folks. And where's the evidence?
Because that happens so...
so often.
I mean, yes, we know that ball lightning is a variety of observable phenomenon. I would argue that whoever this individual that posted this actually knows far less about ball lightning than I do, because I've spent years studying it scientifically at Brown Mountain. What I take to be a ball lightning-esque manifestation that occurs there, I don't say that they're aliens or extraterrestrial. I think that there's a variety of natural phenomenon, an atmospheric phenomenon that occurs at Brown Mountain. I love how someone can say, folks, shut up. Drop the UFO. Can we please can the whole UFO alien thing? This is clearly ball lightning. End of story. Well, you show me your evidence for that. Even if you're right, you can't go on blind faith and assert that. You have to be able to back up your claims with evidence. I'm sorry. We have other folks. And I, of course, was very gentlemanly, but I took these people to task on these sorts of comments because I got tired of it. And then another person comes in and comments and puts stars around these, you know, the air quotes around these, Google ball lightning or ball lightning, not a fleet of space aliens, folks. Again, here we have the skeptical debunker appear on the scene and assure us it's not space aliens. Who said space aliens? Thus far, I'm keeping track. Okay. 2-0. Okay. I never said aliens. Greg Archer, the photographer, never said aliens. Scotty Roberts never said aliens, but I've had two people try to debunk this and say it's ball lightning, which it very well may be, and they tell us, not space aliens, folks. Who said space aliens? You did! I didn't. Oh my gosh.
No, you're just splitting hairs, Micah.
No,
we all know what you meant. You're the UFO guy, Micah.
Well, apparently I am.
You're not the alien guy, the UFO guy.
I'm the UFO guy. Oh, here's a good one. Then Chuck White comments and says, they're Higgs bosons created by the lightning. That's a good one. That's right. We saw little God particles in an array floating over Castle Rock right there. But anyway, and I encourage people, go over there and take a look and just, you know, read on down through these posts, because there are some interesting ones that are included, but the majority of these comments are just... I mean, they're just so abrasive. Here's another one. Sorry, but these aren't good photos. Those light dots could be reflections on a window in front of the photographer. How many times do we have to tell you?
Even though the photo was taken outside.
How many times do we have to tell you? He was outside. Unless he's just a real good liar, he was outside. If they aren't glares, the commenter goes on to say, they are way too far away to make anything out from the photo. This is an example of the reporter having good intentions, but the mature ufologist circles are probably shaking their heads at this. Oh, I see, because we put out some images and said, hey, take a look, what do you think? Never asserting that these were space aliens, of course. But again...
Well, apparently, what do you think means, here's free license to be a huge jerk.
A horse's patoot.
Like, it's, you know what? Not only am I going to give my opinion, I'm going to be a naysaying D-face the whole time.
Okay.
Like, and I mean, I'm a skeptic. I'm a hardcore skeptic. Everyone here knows I don't believe in a majority of paranormal things. But I absolutely believe in not alien UFOs.
Okay, and now here's
because I don't know how we can stress this enough. UFO and alien spaceship are not synonymous.
They don't have to be. They may be, but we again are not armed with enough data to prove that. You know, and by the way, Greg actually mentioned in one of the comments here that he had been standing in the field facing north when the photos were taken. So that's another piece of evidence.
Yeah.
Or information, rather. Okay, that's information to add to what we're trying to gather as evidence. He had been standing in a field facing north in Castle Rock at the time the photos were taken. We know the date, the time, the direction. Okay, we don't know what these objects are. Okay, we don't know. And I'll state again here to those listening that while I cannot prove this either, my working hypothesis is, and I've talked with Greg about this, these could be commercial aircraft lining up coming in for a landing, but what we've got to try and do, knowing the direction he'd been facing and what flight data is available. Here's the thing about flight data, by the way. Generally, a commercial aircraft flight data is archived and it remains accessible for about 4 months. Certain data that's more specific about individual flights only remains for about 2 weeks at a time, as I've been told. So, this being an event that took place on June 6th, some of that more nitpicky data that I'd like to be able to dig up, and it's a little hard to obtain at times anyway, but some of the more intricate data is going to be unavailable at this point anyway, because this took place more than 2 weeks ago. The general data should remain for a period of 4 months, so we've still got time to be able to figure that out. And we can also basically determine from the direction he had been facing, hopefully, that if there were commercial flights coming in for landing at that time, that based on the direction they would have been flying and what airport they had been headed to, we should be able to determine if those are aircraft that were in the air at that time. Now, what's interesting is that if the aircraft had been coming directly toward Greg, and what we were seeing are the lights, first of all, if they hadn't been coming toward him and they'd been moving in a direction, to, let's say, the west or to the east of him, since these are long exposures and the lights were taken in photographs during a period spanning about 20 minutes, there should have been light trails. Other photo analysts who have talked with Greg have pointed that out. They say if it were commercial aircraft he'd been photographing, long exposures taken over a period of 20 minutes. Now, granted, he didn't leave the aperture of the camera open for 20 minutes. I mean, these pictures were taken over a period of 20 minutes. The lights were visible, to the naked eye. If Greg told me, if I'm understanding what he's told me correctly, they were visible to the naked eye for about 5 minutes, and he took some pictures before and after that period as well, where the images appeared on camera nonetheless. If these objects were passing and were headed to the west or to the east, they should have probably left light trails as the aperture of the camera remained open, and of course this exposure took place. If they were headed directly toward him, it's a little difficult to explain why the lights never seem to come lower to the ground if the airport were in the distance away from him, as though they were actually landing, or why the lights never eventually passed over him. They appeared, they remained for a short period, and then they disappeared, which is a little strange, and that seems inconsistent with commercial aircraft. So, but again, I won't rule that out. That seems to be the best and most plausible explanation at the time, but I don't have all the data that we need to be able to prove that. It's a hypothesis, okay? That's the scientific aspect of this, okay? Trying to apply some scientific methodology to all this. But again, I'm looking down through these comments, and I love all this stuff. Like, for instance, here's another one. As a professional photographer, I can tell you that the image is a result of a long exposure. Well, we know that it was a long exposure. And people continue just to go down there, and a lot of them are just really kind of mean. You know, a lot of these people are just absolutely abrasive with the things that they're saying.
Can I say, as a professional photographer, if the images were the result of a long exposure, then that series of light dots would have to be something that was either flashing or illuminated that traveled, stopped for long enough for the light to register, traveled fast enough that the light would not register a trail, stop again, mm-hmm. and so forth for the, six or seven dots that appear on the photo. So even if it were the result of a long exposure...
And that's if it's flight path.
What is it?
That's if the flight path were, again, perpendicular to him. These objects, it wasn't a single object that had been flying along, flashing, and that each flash appeared in the long exposure. These images hovered in the air. Again, Greg told me he was able to see these with the naked eye for a short time. They appeared and they remained hovering in the air. It's pretty difficult to really determine what... Oh, I'm sorry, I've got one more comment here I've got to read, and this is just another really good one. Looking at these photos, all I can see is lightning. I'm a bit puzzled. In New Mexico, I've seen very dramatic lightning strikes, but I didn't call those UFOs. Oh, well, I guess I'll scroll back and look again. Maybe I missed something. Yeah, look a little harder, because there are obvious little pinpoints of light hovering in a line, in a straight line. Now, let's analyze this a bit, okay? So we're seeing several things. Some of the people looking at the photographs obviously didn't look long enough to even be able to see the quote-unquote phenomena that we are referring to in the images. Obviously, most of the commenters did not actually read the article, and even after I wrote in bold letters at the top of the page, update, since posting the photos featured in this article, we've received a number of questions regarding the circumstances, and so I answer, was the photo taken indoors or outdoors? Well, it was outdoors. Two, couldn't these photos be showing lights from incoming commercial airliners? Well, you know, we're trying to gather data about that. And nonetheless, people didn't read a lick of what I'd written, and they scroll right on down, and they assert, look, obviously Chinese lanterns. Would you people shut up?
Well, I mean, I'm looking at the picture now, and if you'll note, in the bottom right-hand or bottom left-hand corner of the photo, there is a small light trail that looks like a question mark.
Yeah.
Assuming that's a vehicle, like a car or a motorcycle, and just guessing the distance, it looks like, yeah, this was a long exposure of maybe, what, a 20 to 30, maybe a 20-second
You know,
open
here's the thing. Here's what you could do. You could actually determine. I mean, granted, you know, Greg, I think somewhere here has already talked about how long the exposures were. If we weren't armed with that data, though, again, you know, there's a lot that you can learn from studying photos like this. If you wanted to know the length of the exposure, all you'd have to do is you'd have to be able to take a photograph in daylight if you could obtain one, determine what that roadway is, and then determine the length of time based on, you know, the speed limit on that roadway that it would take a vehicle to travel that distance as depicted in that photograph. Now, granted, it would help to know the exact location and have that photographer or someone else return to that exact spot and take a photo in the daytime, which Greg has said that he'll do for us. But see, again, the reason I point that out is because there are things you can determine from looking at a photograph like this. And one thing that we know, at least based on what these lights appear to be doing in these photographs and the passage of time between the times the photos were taken, is that these lights, whether they were moving or not, relative to the camera, they appeared to hover in the sky for the duration of the time that they were visible. It's pretty strange. And I don't know what they are. I'm not going to tell you that they're alien spaceships, you know, from outer space or something like that. But there's something interesting here. Maybe some sort of ball lightning-esque natural phenomena, you know, for all we know. That would be just as exciting as anything, you know, entirely inexplicable. And frankly, I don't think that, you know, the lack of any explanation is reason to celebrate. You know,
and even if it is ball lightning, until we determine that, you know what it is? A UAP or a UFO.
It is. We'll have to.
Even if it's ball lightning.
It will, that's the thing, yeah, that's what I'm saying. It will have to remain unexplained. And yes, my friends, it does remain unexplained. But we're going to continue to try and dig up more information about that. But again, I think the cultural commentary perhaps is what's so interesting. People don't want to read, they just want to assert their biases and their preconceptions and tell you that, you know what? You're wrong because you thought, therefore, aliens. Who said aliens? I know I didn't. We'll be back right after this. What can we learn from our ancient past? What is the mystery behind UFOs? Did aliens visit humankind in ancient times? Each of these tests the very boundaries of humankind's ability to reason, and all will be explored this year at the Paradigm Symposium 2012, October 18th through 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Speakers will include Eric Von Daniken, author of Chariots of the Gods, George Norrie of Coast to Coast AM, as well as Giorgio Tsoukalos, Bill Burns, Philip Coppens, and many more. Tickets are selling fast, so reserve yours online today by visiting ParadigmSymposium.com. Reviewing our past and changing our future. For more information, visit ParadigmSymposium.com.
Hey guys, Jamie Havigan here for UFO Mag. Do you want to receive the best writing there is in ufology? The best writers, editors, and flat out the best magazine that ufology can offer? If so, I highly recommend UFO Magazine. You can check it out at ufomag.com. And if you mention that you heard this on radio, you can get 6 issues for $19.95. Check it out, ufomag.com. Don't miss out. And keep up to date on the hottest topics in ufology. For UFO Mag, this is Jamie Havigan.
Welcome back to the program. It is the Grayling Report, where we align ourselves not with belief or debunking. No, my friends, we're the logical center. The center for logic. Maybe the center for the logical center. But I digress. Welcome back to the program, friends. You know, If you head on over to GraylianReport.com, we've included with the show notes for this week's broadcast the short, sharp science section of NewScientist.com, which discussed how Ouija boards help psychologists probe the unconscious. We've also got a story of, well, how one skeptic has faced possible charges for debunking Mumbai's miracle statue. Do you know that skeptics can get in trouble for debunking? This is a pretty interesting story. New Scientist carried this one just as well. Very interesting. According to John White, a man by the name of Sanal Edamaruku faces a Catholic backlash after insisting that the quote-unquote holy water dripping from a statue of Christ in Mumbai, India, get this, came from a leaky drain. I always have trouble with these foreign names. Edamaruku is the founder and president of the Rationalist International. He's president of the Indian Rationalist Association, and he's also an honorary associate of the UK Rationalist Association. The question asked was, what was the so-called miracle that was recently investigated? According to Sanal, the priest and the very active Catholic laity organizations associated with the Our Lady of Vallakanani Church in Mumbai were promoting the idea that water dripping from the feet of a statue of Jesus was a sign from God, okay, a holy miracle. Hundreds of believers flocked to the dripping cross, collecting and consuming quote-unquote holy drainage water that was believed to cure all ailments. Well, Sanal was invited to the Delhi studio of TV9, a Mumbai-based national channel, to comment on this, and during the program, he said, "I rejected the possibility of a miracle, but of course could not give scientific explanations without an investigation. The channel then invited me to come to Mumbai. Church authorities agreed." When asked what he found, he said, "I had a close look at the nearby washroom and the connected drainage system that passed underneath the concrete base of the cross. I removed some stones from the drain and found that it was blocked. I touched the walls, the base, and the cross and took some photographs for documentation. It was very simple. Water from the washroom, which had been blocked in the clogged drainage system, had been transmitted via capillary action and into the adjacent walls from the base of the cross, as well as into the wooden cross itself. Now, that water came out through a nail hole and ran down over the statue's feet." But now, get this. Now, this is interesting. Sanal Edamaruku now faces possible arrest. He says, "Leaders of two Catholic laity organizations have launched charges against me under Section 295A of the Indian Penal Code. This charges a person with, quote, deliberately hurting religious feelings and attempting malicious acts intended to outrage the religious sentiments of any class or community. It is absurd to claim that I did anything of the sort." And if it comes to trial, he says he has nothing to fear. He would welcome the opportunity to throw some light on the role that the Catholic Church played and is still playing today here in India. He said the possibility of arrest is threatening, however. But that's interesting that the man who went to investigate a natural occurrence that was, you know, believed to be a holy miracle now may be arrested for hurting religious feelings. Very interesting. It's interesting that we found this story, by the way, because in the next hour, our guest, Stephen Rumbelow, will be discussing such things as the Holy Grail and the Jesus Papers and some of the stories and the theories associated with, you know, alternative theories associated with Jesus and these sorts of things. Of course, it's not our intention here to hurt religious feelings on the Graylian Report, but we're interested in spirituality and the metaphysical. I pride this program in not just being one that just talks constantly about UFOs and Bigfoot or anything like that. We do try and spend a little time talking about the metaphysical and about spirituality. And in fact, the tremendous response that we've gotten with regard to an interview that we featured on the show a while back, Slavik Vojtovic was the guest. That was probably one of the most popular interviews that we've had on the program in a long time, and we got a tremendous response from people about Slavik and the segment that he did here on the program. You're not going to get really in-depth mystical and metaphysical discussions on a lot of the other paranormal podcasts out there, and that's something that we do try and delve into a good bit, along with the sort of rational skepticism that we were talking about in the last segment with regard to these illuminations over Colorado. It looks like Sanal Edamaruku may face time in prison for trying to exemplify rational skepticism in the face of an alleged miracle going on there in India. Very strange. What do you think, Chris?
I think he should go to jail forever.
Go to jail forever.
Yeah, because that's, you know what he did? That was just It was just malicious.
It hurt somebody's feelings. It sure did.
And that's what happens when you allow things like religion to infiltrate politics.
Yeah.
You go to jail for science.
Well, that's why here in the United States, we hope to have such things as separation of church and state, which isn't really the case in a lot of instances.
Yeah,
but.
I mean, you know what? There's jillions of religions, and if you want to practice...
Literally jillions!
And if you want to practice any number of them, you know, in conjunction with a few others, you know, 1, 10, I don't care. Do what you want, as long as it doesn't influence politics and policies, because... You know, we've got freedom of religion granted by the First Amendment. You know, take out separation of church and state. Freedom of religion means you have the right to pick whatever you want, which means implicitly
that you can pick your nose.
No one has the right to pick what you're going to believe in.
Right.
So,
but should there be laws that when somebody's religious beliefs are hurt, should there be laws that send people, you know, like, you know, scientists? To prison?
Absolutely
for that sort of thing?
Not, because that'd be along the same lines of me going to prison for calling you a poopy face.
Yeah, exactly. And right. How dare you hurt my religious feelings like that?
He told me that my food tasted like burnt cat food, and and so he needs to go to jail, and I don't like him anymore. That's ridiculous. What needs to happen is people need to, for lack of a better phrase, sack up. And deal with things.
Sack up and deal with things, huh? Well, I'll tell you this. There's this other story that was featured at the Bigfoot Evidence blog titled Skeptics Need to Do More Research. Now, again, I consider myself a skeptic, but I think that there's a difference between a reasoned skeptic and then just the faithful debunker.
It's like UFO. UFO and alien spaceship have become synonymous. Skeptic and debunker have become synonymous.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that people are allowing that to be so. Yeah. It's not going to change the fact that I'm a skeptic. I'm not a debunker.
Yeah.
If you want to think I'm a debunker, that's fine. But
no, I'm a skeptic, and I will remain...
I'm going to debunk you thinking I'm a debunker.
We will debunk the debunkers. You know, that reminds me, Scotty, when he was on that panel this weekend, told me that one of the PhDs on the other end of the table said, these people, pointing at Scotty and his associate, these people are just denialists. And when given a chance to respond, Scotty said, I deny that statement.
I'll take that check.
Yeah, I'll take that check. But over at the Bigfoot Evidence blog, Jonathan Paulson did a post there, and he notes in this that the Skeptics Dictionary by Robert Todd Carroll has a short section devoted to Bigfoot. Well, after reading this segment, I was flabbergasted. How could anyone write such an absurd piece of so-called literature? In order to understand my frustration, I'll give you some examples of statements that are one-sided, opinionated, and just downright not true. This is the belief-oriented kind of quote-unquote pseudo-skepticism that I like to call it, at its very finest. One, an ape-like creature. This is how they refer to Bigfoot at the Skeptics Dictionary. Again, a website that really caters to those who associate themselves with the culture that's been built around calling yourself a skeptic, not actual skeptical inquiry. One, Bigfoot, an ape-like creature reportedly sighted hundreds of times around the world since the mid-19th century. Well, Paulson notes that, no, there have been not just hundreds, but exactly, well, actually, I'm sorry, this is a rough figure, but he's writing this, not me, 42,000 sightings and counting. Alleged sightings date back thousands of years in North America. Leif Erikson claimed to have encountered a hairy, dark-skinned creature in Newfoundland in 986 AD. And in Asia, Alexander the Great's men fought against a very large group of what were described, of course, by modern conventional terminology as Yetis. Two, the evidence consists mainly of testimony from Bigfoot enthusiasts, footprints of questionable origin, and pictures that could easily have been of apes or humans in ape suits. Paulson writes, the great majority of eyewitnesses were not researching the subject of Sasquatch prior to their sighting, and afterwards they didn't involve themselves in the field either. The Patterson film could easily have been a human in an ape suit, they say. Well, this is indeed interesting. That's exactly what we're claiming them to be in the first place, apes. Three, there are no bones, no scat, no artifacts, no dead bodies, no mothers with babies, no adolescents, no fur, no explanation of how these species likely are to be communal or have ever been seen in a family or group activity of any sort. Paulson writes, we have bones from the fossil hominid genus Gigantopithecus, which is very similar to the Sasquatch. Scat was recovered from one of Tom Slick's expeditions. Artifacts, you mean like the archaeological relics? Hundreds of accounts of dead bodies being found or hunters shooting them are on record, The most famous of these is the Minnesota Iceman incident of 1968. In the Memorial Day footage, the creature is thought to be a mother with her young. Also, there's the story of Zanna, the Russian Almas, which gave birth to several children. In Albert Ostman's kidnapping, there were two adolescents, both a male and a female. Hair samples are recovered regularly. I have a possible hair sample myself, Paulson notes. Again, in the Albert Ostman kidnapping, there were four individuals, an adult male, an adult female, a young male, and a young female. Also, in Mutualot Harry's alleged 1928 kidnapping, there were a total of 20 Sasquatch living together. Now, I know, honestly, that being interested in this field, I'm well aware of the kind of data that Paulson's discussing here. The problem with it is this, that that information is not going to be something that the skeptical debunker is going to pursue, and therefore they're not going to be armed with that kind of knowledge, and even if they are, they're going to discount those stories because, again, these are stories and there's very little hard evidence that seems to support them. Something I note or notice that Paulson doesn't seem to bring up here, although these may not be representative of Sasquatches per se, are the sorts of documented recovery of remains of large stature that appear in such things as the Bureau of Ethnology's reports to the Secretary of the Smithsonian during the late 1890s. Cyrus Thomas, who was the director, I guess, of the Bureau of Ethnology, reported the discovery of many graves throughout the Southeast that contained 7 to 9 foot tall skeletons, apparently. And these were recorded by the Smithsonian. So there are a few instances where these sorts of things have shown up in modern times as well. I wish he'd noted that because, again, this is something that probably a lot of, you know, skeptics, again, we're skeptics, but I think we'll leave the semantics aside for now. We spent the better part of the last hour discussing the different kinds of skeptical attitudes, some of them good and some of them are no better than those who blindly believe in, you know, aliens from space and these sorts of things. Well, I think that, again, the person who goes into trying to debunk these things has entered this with the preconception that a creature like Bigfoot couldn't exist. Now, it may not be likely, but there is some evidence that seems to support the existence of these creatures. We don't have proof yet, or there wouldn't be an answer, or rather, there wouldn't be an argument, I mean. We wouldn't be arguing this if there were proof, absolute, irrefutable evidence of the existence of a creature like Bigfoot. But there is some evidence that supports, or seems to support, that a creature like this could exist, and that, furthermore, that a variety of similar creatures could exist, anthropomorphic, you know, humanoids, some of them bipedal, okay, that walk upright in other various remote locales around the world. But again, I think it's interesting that someone or an institution like the Smithsonian Institute could actually report the discovery of large skeletons and things, some of them recovered from some of the famous Indian mound excavations that occurred toward the end of the 19th century. And yet this is, again, something that is so often dismissed when we're talking about reports of apparent creatures like Sasquatch. Now, that may not be evidence of Bigfoot, but it's certainly something that seems, well, a little odd. Seems odd to me. Does it seem odd to you? Who knows what's really going on? But who knows? I think that, if anything, we could probably all stand to examine the data a little better and leave our preconceptions at the door as we enter the hallowed temple of inquiry. Let's proceed without our biases. And we're going to proceed on to the next hour of this week's edition of the Grayling Report. At this time, I'm Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this. Micah Hanks of the Grayling Report here. Today I want to talk to you about Intrepid Magazine, the new leader in clear and reasoned thinking in an unpredictable world, and the official magazine of the Grayling Report. Intrepid features the latest in-depth analysis of science, culture, conspiracy, politics, and unexplained phenomena. You'll get expert commentary from an incredible cast of seasoned writers and researchers, as well as interviews and insights from some of the biggest names in the field. And best of all, you can subscribe today for just $14.95. It's Intrepid Magazine. Boldly going. Subscribe today by visiting IntrepidMag.com, and coming soon, look for Intrepid on Nook and Kindle e-readers.
is the Grahamian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grahamian Report with your host, Mike Evans.
Dark storm clouds have swept over the horizon above the MOHO, that is terra firma, the skies above Grahamian International Headquarters. And of course, fortunately, Chris Hayes and I remain underground here for the second hour of this week's edition of the Grahamian Report. Remaining underground in our, well, our fortified bunker hundreds of miles beneath the Earth's surface. You know, Chris, speaking of skeptical debunking and our discussion on skeptics versus belief and debunking last hour, here's what I propose. I propose we start calling those who attach belief and preconception to the act of what they call skeptical debunking, we call those blind bunkers. What do you think?
Well, I mean, that's okay. I mean, but we broadcast from a blind bunker.
It's dark, but we got lights on down here. We are their light in the darkness. That is, of course, you, my dear friends, the listeners. And this hour, we're going to be digging into some really, really, controversial matters, to say the least. We've got a very special guest lined up. But this gentleman, I'm going to tell you about him here in a moment, has been involved in television and all different sorts of paranormalia. And so he'll be a fantastic person to talk to on the program tonight. We're going to dig a little bit into discussions along the lines of the Templars, the Illuminati, the Holy Grail, all these sorts of things that have been so popular ever since the publication of that little book by that guy, Mr. Brown, that little book called The Da Vinci Code. You know, these subjects never seem to get old. Or if they do, we nonetheless seem to find, well, new and interesting material to bring forth about them. But before we dive into that, I do want to remind you, if you haven't already, coast right on over to our website for the Paradigm Symposium 2012. That's paradigmsymposium.com. We put up a blurb at grahamianreport.com the other day talking about how quickly, and I'm not just, you know, talking this up, this is true, the best-selling ticket, I mean, the one that's going to sell out probably within the next few weeks, is the biggest ticket, which of course includes all access to the conference and all the speakers for the entire duration of the conference. And then you've also got the VIP cocktail, the dinner banquet, which includes a panel discussion that will be moderated by our good friend from Coast to Coast AM, Ian Punnett, and George, of course, George Norrie, and Eric Von Daniken, myself, Chris here might even be sitting in on that panel. You want to sit in on a panel discussion with us, Chris?
I demand to be able to sit in on the panel. I have a lot of things to say.
I know you do.
And, you know, they're really eloquent and well thought out, so no, they actually, I don't see why it's even an option.
You know, we're going to be doing a live broadcast of this program from Paradigm Symposium, too. So if you haven't gotten your tickets, I mean, I'm not just trying to be an alarmist. I'm warning you, if you want to be able to attend the VIP access cocktail hour and all that stuff, the biggest ticket is the one that is selling the very fastest. And so you don't want to wait to line up your tickets for that. Go ahead and get those today. They are selling really quick. And there are so many fantastic developments coming together about Paradigm Symposium. We've got a book giveaway also that we're doing, and we've got it linked up to the Paradigm Symposium website as well as to grahamianreport.com, where you can go like our Facebook page and learn how you can win some free books by George Norrie and Bill Burns. We've got all kinds of great stuff going on, so go check that out. What was it? I'm sorry, I forgot something.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, if it lights a fire under anyone in order to join that cocktail hour with the biggest ticket, not only will we be there discussing things and having wonderful libations, but I will be making the cocktails.
Oh, will you? You're
which means you will get the best old-fashioned anyone has ever had, ever.
Oh, man. I tell you, I always like, and call me old-fashioned, but I like bourbon. And I'll tell you what, you know, I understand our friends at Abduction Wine will also be sending along some samples of their products. So we're actually going to have some, yeah, we're going to have some alien-themed wine that we'll be sampling there during that cocktail hour.
Then we need to get some La La Land chocolates to go with the Abduction Wine.
You know, maybe we can do that. That would be great if we can get all our sponsors to contribute some things, you know. We'll get Rick Green at Green Alien Art to do a poster for us. And then we'll have Melody Germain at La La Land Chocolates. Yes, she'll send along some holistic and very healthy, you know, superfood-esque chocolate. I mean, her chocolates really are made with a lot of superfoods and really, truly healthy ingredients. But then, yeah, we get Abduction Wine to send along their samples as well. And then we've just got a really, you know, Grahamian-centric treat for folks who want to attend and join that aspect of Paradigm Symposium. That's October 18th through 21st in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Folks, don't miss out. Check it out at www.paradigmsymposium.com. And now, getting on to our guest this hour, we want to afford him the time, well, that he should be afforded. We are joined this evening by a very special guest, Stephen Rumbelow. He's a television producer and also a researcher of the unexplained. He wrote and directed 52 episodes of Beyond, a well-known paranormal documentary. Tonight, we're going to get into a number of things with him, including the Jesus Papers, the Holy Grail, and, of course, that secret society known throughout the ages as the Illuminati. Can't wait to talk about that with him. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Micah.
So glad to have you here. So now, right off the bat, I got to say, it's been brought to my attention, you actually grew up in a haunted hotel in England. Is that correct?
That's right. And it was actually built on the hanging site of Bristol. And, of course, now it's down right downtown. But at that time, it was the only hill near the it wasn't much bigger than a camp when it was built. And I used to leave people hanging up there for months on end until they fell off, kind of thing. And this house was built 200 years prior to us moving in there. And it had eight entities in there that plagued and made life hell for the guests sometimes. We'd have guests, you know, running out of the hotel in the middle of the night saying, they were gone, and that would happen quite regularly. And I ended up, Mum actually ended up giving me the top two floors of the hotel because the cleaners wouldn't clean up there. Huh. So I was brought up from the age of two with living with phenomena. So I think that's pretty much what sparked me off on this trail, this hobby that I've had paralleling my film career. Mm-hmm. And what made me want to do the Beyond series when that came up,
Yeah, so you really, I mean, you have had a life in this. And it sounds to me like it was a natural progression from your early experiences in the haunted hotel to carry over into Beyond. So how did Beyond come together? Of course, this is well known in the U.S. and in Canada. I'd be interested in hearing how that series came together and how you became involved.
Well, I very much wanted to put together I was a bit disillusioned with programming, with the way programming was happening with paranormal. I very much wanted to put together something that looked at the advances, the current advances that have been made on a scientific level or on an academic or scholarly level with regard to paranormal phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to look at something that I've been dealing with for years, which was I had, as a part of my dealing with actors, found myself working with shamans, who were the original actors, on sort of anthropological field studies, working with shamans in deserts and jungles and what have you around the world, and witnessing these phenomenal occurrences that they were able to create, either by deception or by, a true phenomena. I wanted somehow to process create an encyclopedia, if you will, that people could refer to and get the most up-to-date information on any given subject. So we dealt with 48 subjects of the paranormal, and we approached it from that respect, that we were going to give them the most up-to-date information we could that was reasonable. Mm-hmm. And I'm a great one, I love Joseph Campbell, and I love the notion that when you look at the common ground that exists between phenomena or conspiracies or anything like that, when you look at the common ground that most people experience, you're looking at the closest thing you have to the truth, almost, I got the McLuhan Foundation to do the research for us, to about 15 members of U of T, the McLuhan Foundation, and they asked me if I wanted to be biased, and I said no, but I I want you to go and find proof of life after death if you can. And they came back with 6 banker's boxes of information.
Wow.
It took me months to go through it and to actually choose what we were going to research further. And then I had other researchers researching the stuff, all the signposts that they gave us. And, you know, we came up with stuff like, you know, the super psychic kids, they developed a gene in the super psychic kids. They discovered this gene that was, you know, the super resistant to viruses. It was just a huge amount of information. And it's that wave that went around the world, which included like what the beep do we know, and the secret and stuff like that. That wave of awareness that came into the world. You know, we were very much a part of that wave. I think, you know, we were. Wow, you know, look at this, oh my God, and this is connected with that, and it was incredible working on the series, and I think by the time I finished the series, I had no doubt whatsoever that there is life after death, that I had no doubts that, you know, what we're about to talk about today, that, you know, what had happened there, and other things that I can't even talk about on the air, but for me it was great. I'm working with all these people, all these academics who had open minds, including physicists and hard matter physicists and electrophysicists, and, you know, the people that were actually pointing out phenomena that exist within the outside of the scientific paradigm, mm-hmm. that scientists completely ignore all the time, because it doesn't fit with the paradigm. And they were on the air, you know, and so I was, you know, I was enthusiastically soaking this stuff up, you know.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. And that seems to be sometimes the most gratifying thing, Stephen, is when you have members of academia who are willing to come. Not that, you know, that everyone in academia, you know, everyone in the professional world and, you know, in the realm of the sciences, you know, in physics and whatnot, not to say that they aren't open-minded, but, you know, that there is, you know, often there is this scoffing attitude that people take when you bring up such things as life after death. And when you talk about, as you have, trying to find proof of something like that, you know, people just roll their eyes. They just as soon... you know, take a vacation or a holiday, you know, is to take that that sort of a thing seriously, you know?
Yes, because that was, in fact, the thing that amazed me the most was that when they came back, they showed me 6 forms of energy that survived clinical death in the body. Some have proven to go on, like somatites, for millions of years. There was no due date on a somatite. You know, they've never found a dead somatite, even in amber, in flies in amber. You know, so you have this incredible, these 6 forms of energy that survive clinical death. That are all part of the scientific paradigm. They're all scientifically correct. What amazed me was that when you have these debunkers, you know, there was actually one professor we had on the series who desperately wanted to get the debunker. He wanted us to do an episode on debunkers, and we decided that we would try to do that. We tried to get a bunch of the popular paid debunkers to come on the program for free, because we wouldn't pay anybody, because we didn't want anybody to accuse us of hiring our answers. And they wouldn't come on the program, and they definitely didn't want to come on the program and go head-to-head with people that were working, you know, that were professors at universities that were questioning their method of debunking. Because a lot of people in the academic community now will not publish their papers because they fear... There's one outfit in Sweden, a debunking outfit that comes in. They take your papers to qualify your work. Then they replicate it with a missing element. They then discredit you But meanwhile, they have your papers, and by all accounts, they're working for corporations who then get the paperwork with the real experimentation, knowing that it works. Meanwhile, the people who've been discredited lose their grants and their positions or whatever. So now what they're doing is they're saying, oh, no, we won't publish because we don't want to be debunked. Hmm. And they hold on until they've got it sort of sold.
Yeah.
You know. Those people, and you know, I think it was PsyCops when that started, you know, they sold out their membership to scientists on the basis of the fact that they were going to debunk astronomy. And when they came up with their findings, they found that their findings were in support of the phenomenon. So what they did was they announced to their membership that they were going to be late coming up with their paperwork because they had to create a new study because it didn't conform with their anticipated debunking goal. Mm-hmm. At which point, and this is a credit to the scientific community, to the academic community that were members at that point, half of the membership went away. Half of the membership jacked in their membership and left because they realized that it wasn't being done in a fair and just manner.
Right. There are a lot of preconceptions, really, that, whether you're a believer or I don't like to say skeptic. I like to say debunker. I notice you use that term, too, because I think a lot of people who go into into any avenue of interest, honestly and openly inquiring and trying to gather data, we all have to be a bit skeptical. You know, skepticism doesn't mean...
Absolutely.
Yes.
Even more skeptical in certain respects.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've got to think, we've got to be the ones that point out the light anomalies or the dust particles or whatever, the differences between a real luminescent phenomenon and a reasonable one. Because if we don't, we just look stupid. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And it's a weird,
You have to be very careful. You have to be very careful. Yeah. And that's why I say, as I've noticed that you do too, Stephen, that there are maybe believers, and it's okay to believe if there's evidence that supports a belief, but then there are the debunkers, and I see that a debunker, rather than a skeptic, is a person who goes in armed with their own set of belief and values, beforehand, and then they go into a situation and they try and justify that same preconception, just like the blind faithful would do just as well.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at it, it's the religionists of, and the scientific religionists, there's not that much of a difference between them when you look at them historically and you say, okay, we've known for thousands and thousands of years that the Earth was not flat, but it was proven twice in ancient Greek society. Aristarchus, when he observed the eclipse going over over the moon, okay, the Earth must be round, and then it was proved mathematically later on, and the Greek, Aristotelian paradigm couldn't accept that because they said the Earth was flat because to them it looked flat. So they said, okay, we can't, although this is mathematically proven, we can't accept this, so we'll put it aside. And then every time it came back up again, it was the theory was shot down by both the scientific community of the day and the religious community of the day, whether it was Galileo or Magellan or, whoever, all these people that we always knew. The Persians knew thousands of years ago. They climbed up to the top of a mountain, looked at the Earth, and the Earth looked as though it was falling away, so it had to be spherical.
Mm-hmm.
It's those extremes of fear, that any dogma creates. That is the enemy of forward progress in thinking, I think.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. And, you know, and coming back to something else you mentioned earlier, to me, Stephen, that seems to be what leads to a lot of the suppression of information, you know, whether it be an organization with its preconceptions buying someone out and suppressing certain, you know, scientific data or papers from coming out, or if it's the actual technology itself that's spirited away. You know, and I think that that sort of thing applies not only to energy systems and the like, but maybe, you know, to an extent to the sorts of technologies we may see behind certain unidentified aerial phenomena along the lines of a UFO craft.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how can you, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the Arizona lights or whatever, you know, or the 1990s, the early 90s display that went on in Mexico City after the eclipse. You can't deny that they happened, you know, and you can't call them flares and you can't call them balloons, you know,
right.
They're obviously not. You know, there are things that can be, you know, it's like the crop circles, you know, the guys that go around and say, okay, well, you know, I'm a crop circle, you know, I fake crop circles. Some of those crop circles are fake and some of them aren't. You can tell which ones aren't.
Yeah.
By the way, the stalks are exploded from the inside. You know, it's like a doctor that looks up and says, "Well, the hag phenomenon is just a, you know, a sleep disorder."
Mm-hmm.
But it's not, because sleep disorders aren't hag phenomena. they aren't, you know, people don't wake up in the middle of the night with a hag on their chest and a shadow at the bottom of the bed. You know, every time they have a sleep disorder.
I'll tell you this. You know, I've actually personally experienced sleep paralysis, and on one occasion, I actually had the classic what you would call what is referred to as the old hag. You know, which was this feeling of pressure. It was actually not on my chest, but on my thighs, as though there were someone who I took to be a female sitting there, like on my kneecaps, just sitting there, kind of like looking at me.
Yeah.
And it was very strange. But I've talked with other people who have, you know, aside from the traditional sleep paralysis experience, I've spoken with people who have said that they've, you know, literally woken up fully awake, fully aware, able to move, but with a ghost, you know, in period dress sitting on their chest, you know, sitting there looking at them. I mean, it's pretty interesting. I think that every now and then there are experiences that step outside that known scientific, you know, established experience, for instance, like sleep paralysis. But now, real quick, I want to come back to the crop circles with you for a moment. You know, there was a gentleman who, over the weekend, just in conversation, brought up crop circles to me and asked my opinion. And I said, well, I think a lot of them obviously are man-made. And then he said, well, you know, I'd watched this television program about crop circles, and it delved into how some of these are so elaborate, and that there's just simply, you know, if there is any way that these were people working by night, there would have to have been a lot of them, and they would have to have been incredibly experienced. And to date, we have never seen anyone, as far as this documentary had put forth with the information provided, they had never seen a group that could do so reliably and so well the patterns that appear in some of these crop circle formations. What is your take on the crop circles, and did you ever cover that in Beyond on the series?
Yeah, we did. The big difference between the crop circles that are made and the crop circles the crop circles that are made by ordinary people is that they press them down with a board, and those stalks are crushed. When they're broken and they're pressed down and they're crushed. The circles that are made the other way by whatever phenomenon it is that makes them, whether it's a natural phenomenon, whether it's UFO, there is an upswelling of energy from the ground that comes up through the stalks, and the stalks explode from the inside out, and you see where the joints are, where they've fallen over. You can see the result of that little explosion of energy, which has shredded them from the inside out. And that is a very simple way of proving whether it's been created, man-made or not. Now there are people that the theorizers, and there's one climatologist, I can't remember his name, who says that he thinks that it's a weather phenomenon that happens with electromagnetic force from storms, from the edge, from the higher, from the atmosphere. I know that, you know, all of the authentic. But here's something. When you see, when it's very easy to tell whether something is CGI or not. Mm-hmm. And what tells you whether it's CGI or not is the time code on the event. And that time code gets transferred on any copies that are made. So if you go suddenly, when something weird happens on a thing, if you go from interlaced to progressive scan on your time code, then you know that it's been messed with. It's very easy to tell. And I've looked at firsthand footage of orbs, large orbs flying over crop formation, things like that, and they were not doctored. It was first generation, and it was not doctored. It was all interlaced, and it was continuous time code. So, from my perspective, the crop circle is a phenomenon. I don't know whether, you know, Hoagland has the right answer to it, or whether it's a climatologist or whatever. But I do think, you know, whether it's ball lightning or whether it's some kind of UFO, a scout device or whatever. I've also had a couple of run-ins with what I call UFOs too, and I was completely confounded by them, whether they were of this earth or you know, new technology. It was hard to tell, but right. Certainly they seem to behave in a non three-dimensional way, which tends to support, from my point of view, the torsion field kind of theory, which is that these things are interdimensional. They're not because they don't behave in a three-dimensional way. They don't conform to physics.
People often say, yes, they don't seem to conform to physics. I would argue, of course, and perhaps you would agree, that maybe they do conform to physics, but certainly not known physics that we have applications, designed for dealing with.
Yes, you're quite right. Absolutely, of course. Yeah.
Very interesting. Right. But then again, you know, that brings us back to the sort of religion, that is the modern science, establishment. If we don't have that data, if we're not armed with that knowledge, well, then we're no good, and therefore we have to dismiss it. And speaking of religion, speaking of religion in the very true sense of religion, before we run out of time, we've still got a good ways to go, but I want to ask you about some of this research that you've done into what are known as the Jesus Papers. Now, I've asked a number of people over the last few days, are you familiar with the Jesus Papers? And the typical response I get is, well, which set or which Jesus Papers? So I know that you're very, very knowledgeable about this subject. Why don't you give us a little background about that and how your research gets into that?
The Jesus Papers... we did a trilogy because it was such a big subject that covered the Grail, the Templars, the Jesus Papers, and what have you. And we had a number of we had a Master Mason, we had a Rabbi, we had professors, theologians, and so on. The Jesus Seminar is a group of academics, scholars, who study the Jesus Papers, and they have gone to the papers to try and find historical accuracy when it comes to Christ. And they're not limited to the books that were chosen in the Nicaea to form the New Testament, but they're using all of the papers, including the Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Nag Hammadi documents and so on, and all the other, the Gnostic Gospels, which include the Gospel of Joseph, Judas, Thomas, which is a tremendous, you know, which is the Gospel of Saints, and actually the oldest of the Gospels, that is, the closest to Christ's time, is the Gospel of Thomas. And that is the one that says, if you want to find heaven, you have to turn inward. You have to look inside of yourself. You find yourself, you'll find heaven. Right? And Thomas is the one who exposed the fact that Christ and Mary Magdalene were partners, and the disciples were upset about it. They went to Christ one day and they said, "What are you doing? She's a woman. She can't even go into heaven. You know, and you share all this knowledge with her, and you don't share with us." And Christ said, "Well, yeah, that's right. You know, because God won't let a woman into heaven. Will he? You know, and they're standing there, and he says, "So why don't we dress her up as a man and teach her to behave like a man, and then maybe she get into heaven? What do you think?" a kind of bite that Christ had that we don't really perceive him as having in the blue-eyed blonde kind of Christ corporate view of today. So what they came up with, they came up with things that overlapped. Things that like John, for example, the Gospel of John, which is in the New Testament, was written up to 300 years later. There are elements of John that were written 300 years later that are quite fantastic, that have nothing to do with the New Testament at all. That most of half of the New Testament was written by Paul, and half of that was written by the real Paul, and half of that was written by the pseudo Paul. And at a different time altogether, what they've done is they've proved these amazing things, and they come up with what was likely to be history and what was not. And basically, what they came up with was that Christianity was not the intended goal of Christ. He was a Jew, and he was advocating reform within the Jewish faith, that Christ was not God, that Christ probably did not die on the cross, or maybe didn't die on the cross, but that Christ had children with Mary Magdalene, and Mary Magdalene moved out of Palestine. And that there was a major conflict after Christ departed from the scene, after he left, there was a major conflict between Paul and James. James was Christ's brother, and James carried on the church in Christ's name and was very successful at that time. But Paul took it out of the realm of the Hebrews and took it into Europe with his version, which was a very different kind of Christianity to the kind of Christianity that Christ was teaching. Christ then, we see that Nicaea, the Council of Nicaea that chose the Bible, which was under the Roman influence of Constantine, they said, basically, the woman could never, because Paul was very misogynistic in many ways, that nobody could get into heaven but the mother of Christ. No woman could. What happened was we believe that Magdalene ended up in the south of France living in a cave and gave birth to Christ's offspring. Well, the question is whether or not, we don't know. So from there, we then find out that a few hundred years later, this cult develops in the south of France. Then these nine guys go from the south of France in the 12th century, go from the south of France to the Pope. And normally, if a king went to see the Pope, he could get in to see the Pope within a month. These guys got in immediately, the day they arrived to see the Pope. They got in immediately. They carried a document. They showed the Pope that document. He saw them immediately. 2 weeks later, he announced the formation of what became the Templars, who were a contingent of nine men, nine knights. Those nine knights were supposed to, their published purpose was to create safe transport for people to the Holy Land. But nine men couldn't do that. They went straight to the Holy Land, which was then, at that time, it was held, Jerusalem was held by a contingent of crusaders, 500 men. And they were so impressed with these poor knights that they allowed them access. They wanted access to the temple, to the temple men. And they allowed them access. They gave them free access. And then they became known as the Templars because of the Temple Mount.
See.
Now the Templars then became the most powerful religious order in the world. They created the first American Express. You'd go in, give them money in London, and they would give you a coded message, which you would then take to wherever you're going, any destination in France or the Holy Land or wherever. And the Templars there would read the coded message and give you the equivalent in cash there. So it was the first American Express card, basically. It was all done on codes. So these codes were also built into their architecture. They discovered something at the Temple Mount. We don't know what it was, but we do know that it was connected with Mary Magdalene in some way, because Mary Magdalene became big in there, and they used the skull and crossbones as a symbol, being of death, being that Christ had died, being that, you know, and all of their depictions of Mary Magdalene show her with a big belly, being pregnant. Mm. It was the Templars who created this thing. Part of the thing is based on the Ashbat cipher, which is all around Baphomet, which is basically the female divine element of God, Sophia, which is knowledge. Right? So there you see there the link between, you know, the notion of God the divine and God the female and God the male. You start seeing Magdalene occurring in their architecture and in their codexes as Sophia. And that's the way they relate to it. Well, they go on building temples, right? They build temples all the way to the Holy Land, and then they carry on to the Yemen and Ethiopia, towards Ethiopia, as close as you can get to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is where the Ark of the Covenant ended up. So they see there's some kind of link between the Ark of the Covenant and the Templars and Mary Magdalene.
There's definitely something going on. And it's funny, Chris Hayes, you know, my producer here in studio with me, he and I had spoken about this just the other day. I believe it was Graham Hancock that was a proponent of the theory that the Ark had ended up in Ethiopia, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, Graham Hancock. You know, Stephen, do you think that there's some truth to that, and that there may be parallels to these mysteries, you know, hundreds and some of them thousands of years old now, that still exist in our midst today?
I've got to tell you, this is very, very important, because this goes on. Mm-hmm. This goes on to us in the USA today.
Okay.
This incredible thing, the Ark, we know the Ark made it there for a number of reasons, because of temples, Jewish temples there, but also because of the tin cup ceremonies, which have to brought out and paraded in the streets, and danced around and stuff. So yes, absolutely, the Ark made it there. I'm certain of that. But what happened was, the king of Ethiopia, 200 years after the temples had been formed, king of Ethiopia goes and has an immediate audience with the then pope and pleads with the pope to disband the Templars for reasons he would only give to the pope. Hmm. He left the audience with the pope, and the pope immediately announced the disbanding of and the arrest of the Templars. Jacques de Molay was burned as a heretic. You know, the general of the Templars was burned as a heretic. And that day, as he when they were going to burn him, he said, "The Pope won't live past 6 days," hmm. And the Pope was dead within 6 days.
Wow!
But not only that, the Templars had the biggest navy in the world, and they took flight. Nobody knows where to. But they took flight under the flag of Magdalene, which is the skull and crossbones.
That image, of course, if anything, it sort of permeates our culture these days.
The skull and crossbones was the, and so these people took to the sea. We know that they took whatever knowledge they had and they took it to Scotland and hid themselves within the Masons. And I know, because of my connection with the Masons and what have you, that they became an important cornerstone of the Masonic thing. Now, within that period of time, that they were actually in power, right? They were trying very hard to explain to the public that love was beyond state and beyond church and beyond, in a sense, the divine. That it was so divine, it was pure. It was the purity of God was love, right? Now, I think that what they were trying to do was they were trying to prepare people to accept the truth that Mary Magdalene and Christ were man and wife, basically, and had kids. And they were trying to tell the people. Now, how they did it was they engineered a thing that Joseph Campbell called the Revolution of the Balladeers, and which swept Europe at that time. And they introduced to Europe the notion of Tristan and Isolde. You know, the king sends out his knight to get his new wife, and he sends out his most trusted knight. His most trusted knight falls in love with her. She falls in love with him, and they kill themselves because they can't cope with destroying their kings. Going against their king.
Okay.
Same story, basically, with Camelot and Arthur.
Yes.
Right. It's the notion of, you know, and that's the Holy Grail. Notion of love being above the state, and the King Arthur couldn't do it, so this King Charlemagne can't. You know, you can't command love. The Pope can't command love. Love is above all of that. Right. So, having established that thought, and that thought ran like a ripple through Europe over a period of about 10 years. Being given to the people, not the authorities, but to the people, they were being. Within 10 years, Magna Carta was signed.
Hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And Magna Carta led to all these other elements of this new democracy that was growing out of this thought that love was above and beyond the state. Now, that democracy, when you look happened later on, how that led to like the, half the people that, the people that threw the tea in the bay in Boston were Masons. Half the people that signed the Declaration of Independence were Masons. There was a movement throughout Europe at that time, which was to create a democracy. And what better place to do it in than a brand new country? And Beethoven gave us clues to that. Beethoven spoke about that. And he said that if he was younger, he would move to the United States. And then, you know, there was the War of Independence and all that stuff. At the same time in Europe, you've got the French Revolution happening. And the French are throwing off the state.
Right.
Well, my contention is that it was all born of the Templars. And the Templars started the notion, started the thought. The thought led to democracy of the kind that we have, modern democracy.
Hmm.
But then, now I get this, the key to the Masons, the key image of the Masons, or one of the key images of the Masons, are the two pillars, which are the pillars of Enoch. Was supposed to contain the knowledge of mankind. If you look at before 9/11, the World Trade Center, the two towers, the twin pillars, you look at Bay Street in Toronto, you've got twin towers, which is their financial district. You've got twin towers on top of that. You've got twin towers. You've got almost anywhere in the world that is built post that period has a pair of towers in their financial district, which is, to me, you know, beyond accidental.
It's very interesting how that symbology is very pervasive, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and you know, of course, the Masonic symbology on currency and stuff like that. Well, when you look at that, right, and you see that America has the highest buildings that are you know, symbolic of masonry, that you know, and the Masons, the Masons are, I'm talking now about the Masons, the ancient free and accepted Masons, the Freemasons, which are separate from any other kind of Masons. They aren't to do with Skull and Bones. They aren't to do with Illuminati. They aren't to do with the Jesuits. They aren't to do any of those. In fact, if you're connected with any of those, you can't be a Mason, or you can't remain a Freemason.
Right.
If you're connected with any of those, because the Freemasons are law-abiding, and their self-professed thing is to make good men better. There's nothing really bad about the Freemasons. They may have lived through bad times when values were different, but certainly today the values are very innocuous, very, very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the Illuminati or you know, things that, you know, Crowley was doing and stuff like that.
Right.
So, and it's interesting to note that those twin towers came down under the watch of a clandestine Mason, a member of the Skull and Bones Society.
Right. Absolutely. A lot of known ties there. In fact, a lot of known ties along those lines among a lot of those U.S. presidents, especially. You know,
yeah.
Stephen, before we're out of time, I want to ask you, so is there a connectedness? You know, when we see that there are these parallels and these cultural motifs that come forward, some of these handed down throughout the centuries, and then we see our, you know, political leaders and things like this today, the continuous prevalence of the symbology of skull and bones and some of the Templar, influence and things like this. Are these things, again, really indicative of, you know, a pervasive presence in our culture today, maybe that some would call the Illuminati? Is that what we're looking at here?
No. No, it's quite the opposite. And what's happening is that the Illuminati are getting... These things are connected, but they're not connected with the Illuminati. The Illuminati are a despicable, as far as I'm concerned, organization who are... They jump on the tails of the good guys and pretend to be good guys, you know.
Yeah.
And what they've done is they've managed to disperse the reputation of the good guys. People think, you know, if you make it to 33rd degree Mason, that you're one of these evil wizards and blah blah blah. It's not true. It's a clerical, it's a bureaucratic status. Within once you make it a third degree Mason, you can't go any higher. You can go into bureaucratic positions within the Masons, and that determines the other 30 degrees. But they're not to do with special knowledge of demonology or whatever. Nothing to do with that. That's happening within the Illuminati, and those people, they do have, you know, and the Catholic organization as well. They are. They are and have been involved with very negative disruption of society, and I think today, you know, one of the things that you're seeing in America today is the devolution of that democracy, and you will see that in recent years the Masons have become a lot more transparent. And they've also been trying to recruit good people. They've been finding good people to recruit because, you know, things are facing off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're facing off now.
Hmm.
Right now, you know, when you've got the kind of money that's being put into disrupting our, you know, we don't want to become China.
Right. That's a terrifying prospect for a lot of people, you know, myself included. Just the general state of global affairs right now.
Yes.
You know, Stephen, I have to say, you know, we're about out of time. It's been fantastic talking with you. You got a lot of different perspectives on things. That's always refreshing. I got to ask also, what's the next project? What are you moving on to after this?
Well, at the moment, I'm working on a film called Over the Edge, which is a supernatural thriller. And we're about to actually distribute a film called The Covenant, which is also a supernatural thriller that starts in November. That's released in November. And right now we're looking at we're promoting Beyond again, and we're looking at creating some updated episodes for Beyond to update information and keep it current.
Oh, fantastic. That sounds good. You know, we need more of that. And if there's anything we can do here at Graylian International to help out with that, you always let us know, okay?
Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
It has been really nice talking here.
Stephen, it really has been good talking, and I hope sincerely that maybe you'll join us again at some point in the future here on the Graylian Report. But for now, unfortunately, I think that's about going to have to be it. You know, Chris, before we completely run out of time, I do want to ask you, what are your thoughts about the ideas that Stephen talked about with us there? This is always controversial stuff. I'm fascinated by it. You know, sometimes I wonder if we'll ever really know the entire truth. But, you know, being a resident theologian here at Graylian International, I wanted to give you a moment to, you know, toss any ideas you may have out there as well.
Well, I mean, I always like hearing the ideas espoused by people like Stephen and his peers. I don't want to say it's all very reminiscent of the Da Vinci Code, because obviously that's a work of fiction.
Right.
But I mean, there are prevailing themes throughout. The only issue I have, and it's not with Stephen at all, is with the Jesus seminar in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I mean, it's just, it's immediately operating under intellectual dishonesty.
Oh, really? How so?
Yeah, because you're already operating from the point of view that, yes, Jesus existed and he was the Son of God. That is already intellectually dishonest. You need to start from the viewpoint of, was there a Jesus? Can we verify at all that there was a Jesus, man or deity?
Mm-hmm.
Two, if there was a Jesus, how is there any way at all we can, aside from the anecdotal evidence, if you want to call it that, the anecdotal writings that are in the canonical Bible or in any of the extraneous texts, because that's not even verifiable at all. It's all written like a fiction. It's not. There's no way we can prove that with any sort of veracity, because we can't go back in time and see, hey, oh, there's that guy Jesus.
Certain aspects of it without time travel are, in a historical or a scientific sense, difficult to prove. And so I think, you know, for the religious among us, you know, it comes down to a matter of faith. And I'll tell you this. I've always said this, by the way. If it were revealed conclusively that, yes, you know, a Jesus existed, but that, yes, he had also been married to Mary Magdalene, I don't think that I would be so troubled by that, you know, because, again, that shows, I think, the human side of this person who, you know, the Bible tells us was the Son of God, but also who was supposed to be an individual who was not literally God. He was, according, again, to the Judeo-Christian tradition, God made man. Why would he not have those, you know, human characteristics? And furthermore, if this is the other thing I've argued in a Jeffersonian sense, if I were ever told conclusively that there had not been a Jesus at all whatsoever, let's look at it philosophically for a moment. You know, the story of that individual and the knowledge that we hope to gain from studying his life and his actions, I think that that's something that we could still take something from, as well as we could still take, again, in a philosophical sense, from the study of someone like Siddhartha, you know, or the study of many, you know, religious leaders and spiritualists throughout history, because essentially the essence of the teaching there is that we act, you know, in accordance to, you know, the goodness that we hope, again, that others will give to us. We act in that manner toward others. We help others and we love others. I talk about on this program very often cosmic love, which I liken more to being kind of a sense of awareness and a sense of sort of enlightened thought that allows us to better connect with other individuals around us. But the thing is I think that so often the religious institutions today do get so far away and do get so caught up in the ritual that they don't think about what it really means to be good to one another, which seems to be the principle underlying all these religions. How do we lose that in the mix when that's really the most important element? Philosophically, whether or not these people existed, can't we learn something about studying these traditions and these mythologies and hoping to better ourselves?
Well, yeah, and that's what I've been saying for years. I don't necessarily believe that Gautama Buddha was, you know, was the progenitor of the Buddhist philosophy, or that he meditated for 25 years in a cave and attained enlightenment. I know Siddhartha Gautama Buddha was an actual human being. He is in the recorded historical archives of India. He was a prince. That is known. But any deity or I guess demigod or leader of a religion 2,000 years ago, there's no way to know they were real. But that doesn't detract from, I don't want people to think it detracts from my belief in the philosophies espoused by those people, whether they were real or not. It doesn't matter, like you said, if Jesus was a real person or not. A majority of his teachings are good and are things we can learn from, and they're also represented in all religions around the world, and there's got to be something that counts for. If the golden rule is in every society maybe it's a good idea.
Well, you know, and that's the whole thing. But despite trying, I think you do a very good job keeping yourself, you know, aligned in the center there. But, you know, you're never going to make everybody happy. We hope that we continue to make our listeners happy. And, of course, we always encourage you to think and ask questions. And on behalf of Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, Holly, and, of course, yours truly, the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, I bid you adieu, my friends. It is the Graylian Report. Keep thinking. And, as always, until next time, my friends, stay strange.